we came to know the curious roadside species Hitchhiking Man, Homo Pollex of science, with all his many subspecies and forms. The modest soldier, spick and span, quietly waiting, quietly conscious of khaki's viatic appeal. The schoolboy wishing to go 2 blocks. The killer wishing to go 2,000 miles. The mysterious, nervous, elderly gent with brand new suitcase and clipped moustache. A trio of optimistic Mexicans. The college student, displaying the grime of vocational outdoor work as proudly as the name of the famous college arching across the front of his sweatshirt. The desperate lady whose battery has just died on her. The clean-cut, glossy-haired, shifty-eyed, white-faced young beasts in loud shirts and coats, vigorously, almost priapically, thrusting out tense thumbs to tempt lone women or sad-sack salesmen with fancy cravings. "Let's take him," Lo would often plead, rubbing her knees together in a way she had, as some particularly disgusting Pollex, some man of my age and shoulder-breadth, with the fass-a-clack of an unemployed actor, walking backwards practically in the path of our car. Oh, I had to keep a very sharp eye on Lo, little limp Lo. Owing perhaps to constant amorous exercise, she radiated, despite her very childish appearance, some special languorous glow which threw garage fellows, hotel pages, vacationists, goons in luxurious cars, maroon morons near blued pools, into fits of concupiscence which might have tickled my pride had it not incensed my jealousy. For little Lo was aware of that glow of hers, and I would often catch her coulant un regard in the direction of some amiable male, some grease monkey, with a sinewy golden-brown forearm and a watch-braceleted wrist. And hardly had I turned my back to go and buy this very low a lollipop than I would hear her and the fair mechanic burst into a perfect love song of wisecracks. When, during our longer stops, I would relax after a particularly violent morning in bed, and out of the goodness of my lulled heart allow her, indulgent hum, to visit the Rose Garden or Children's Library across the street where the motor court neighbours plain little Mary and Mary's 8-year-old brother, Lo would come back an hour late with barefoot Mary trailing far behind and the little boy metamorphosed into 2 gangling, golden-haired high school uglies, all muscles and gonorrhea. The reader may well imagine what I answered my pet when, rather uncertainly, I admit, she would ask me if she could go with Carl and Al here to the roller-skating rink. I remember the first time, a dusty, windy afternoon, I did let her go to one such rink. Cruelly, she said it would be no fun if I accompanied her, since that time of day was reserved for teenagers. We wrangled out a compromise. I remained in the car, among other empty cars, with their noses to the canvas-topped open-air rink, where some 50 young people, many in pairs, were endlessly rolling round and round to mechanical music, and the wind silvered the trees. Dolly wore blue jeans and white high shoes, as most of the other girls did. I kept counting the revolutions of the rolling crowd, and suddenly she was missing. When she rolled past again, she was together with 3 hoodlums, who I had heard analyse a moment before the girl skaters from the outside, and jeer at a lovely leggy young thing who had arrived clad in red shorts instead of those jeans or slacks. At inspection stations on highways entering Arizona or California, a policeman's cousin would peer with such intensity at us that my poor heart wobbled. "Any honey?" he would inquire, and every time my sweet fool giggled. I still have, vibrating all along my optic nerve, visions of Lo on horseback, a link in the chain of a guided trip along a bridle trail. Lo, bobbing at a walking pace, with an old woman rider in front and a lecherous redneck dude rancher behind, and I behind him, hating his fat, flowery-shirted back even more fervently than a motorist does a slow truck on a mountain road. Or else at a ski lodge I would see her floating away from me, celestial and solitary, in an ethereal chairlift, up and up to a glittering summit where laughing athletes stripped to the waist were waiting for her. For her! In whatever town we stopped, I would inquire, in my polite European way, anent the whereabouts of natatoriums, museums, local schools, the number of children in the nearest school, and so forth. And at school bus time, smiling and twitching a little, I discovered this tic nerveux because cruel Lo was the first to mimic it. I would park at a strategic point, with my vagrant schoolgirl beside me in the car, to watch the children leave school. Always a pretty sight. This sort of thing soon began to bore my so easily bored Lolita. And having a childish lack of sympathy for other people's whims, she would insult me and my desire to have her caress me while blue-eyed little brunettes in blue shorts, copperheads in green boleros, and blurred boyish blondes in faded slacks passed by in the sun. As a sort of compromise, I freely advocated whenever and wherever possible the use of swimming pools with other girl children. She adored brilliant water and was a remarkably smart diver. Comfortably robed, I would settle down in the rich post-meridian shade after my own demure dip, and there I would sit, with a dummy book or a bag of bonbons or both, or nothing but my tingling glands, and watch her gambol rubber-capped, bepearled, smoothly tanned, as glad as an ad, in her trim-fitted satin pants and shirred bra. Pubescent sweetheart! How smugly I would marvel she was mine, 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 and revise the recent matutinal swoon to the moan of the mourning doves, and devise the late afternoon one, and slitting my sun-speared eyes, compare Lolita with whatever other nymphette's parsimonious chants collected around her for my anthological delectation and judgment. And today, putting my hand on my ailing heart, I really do not think that any of them ever surpassed her in desirability, or if they did, it was so two or three times at the most, in a certain light, with certain perfumes blended in the air, once in the hopeless case of a pale Spanish child, the daughter of a heavy-jawed nobleman, and another time, mais je divague. Naturally, I had to be always wary, fully realizing in my lucid jealousy the danger of those dazzling romps. I had only to turn away for a moment to walk, say, a few steps in order to see if our cabin was at last ready after the morning change of linen, and lo and behold, upon returning, I would find the former, les yeux perdus, dipping and kicking her long-toed feet in the water on the stone edge of which she lolled, while on the other side of her there crouched a brun adolescent, whom her russet beauty and the quicksilver in the baby folds of her stomach were sure to cause to se tordre. Oh, Baudelaire, in recurrent dreams for months to come. I tried to teach her to play tennis, so we might have more amusements in common, but although I'd been a good player in my prime, I proved to be hopeless as a teacher. And so, in California, I got her to take a number of very expensive lessons with a famous coach, a husky, wrinkled old-timer with a harem of ball-boys. He looked an awful wreck off the court, but now and then, when in the course of a lesson to keep up the exchange, he would put out, as it were, an exquisite spring blossom of a stroke and twang the ball back to his pupil. That divine delicacy of absolute power made me recall that 30 years before I had seen him in Cannes demolish the great Gobert. Until she began taking those lessons, I thought she would never learn the game. On this or that hotel court I would drill low and try to relive the days when in a hot gale, a daze of dust and queer lassitude, I fed ball after ball to gay, innocent, elegant Annabel, gleam of bracelet, pleated white skirt, black velvet hairband. With every word of persistent advice, I would only augment Lowe's sullen fury. To our games, oddly enough, she preferred, at least before we reached California, formless pat-ball approximations, more ball-hunting than actual play, with a wispy, weak, wonderfully pretty in an ange-gauche way, coeval. A helpful spectator, I would go up to that other child and inhale her faint, musky fragrance as I touched her forearm and held her knobby wrist and pushed this way or that her cool thigh to show her the backhand stance. In the meantime, Lo, bending forward, would let her sunny brown curls hang forward as she stuck her racket like a crippled stick into the ground and emitted a tremendous ugh of disgust at my intrusion. I would leave them to their game and look on, comparing their bodies in motion, a silk scarf round my throat. This was in South Arizona, I think, and the days had a lazy lining of warmth, and awkward Lo would slash at the ball and miss it and curse and send a simulacrum of a serve into the net and show the wet, glistening young down of her armpit as she brandished her racket in despair, and her even more insipid partner would dutifully rush out after every ball and retrieve none. But both were enjoying themselves beautifully, and in clear, ringing tones kept the exact score of their ineptitudes all the time. One day, I remember, I offered to bring them cold drinks from the hotel and went up the gravel path and came back with two tall glasses of pineapple juice, soda and ice, and then a sudden void within my chest made me stop as I saw that the tennis court was deserted. I stooped to set down the glasses on a bench and, for some reason, with a kind of icy vividness, saw Charlotte's face in death. And I glanced around and noticed Lo in white shorts receding through the speckled shadow of a garden path in the company of a tall man who carried two tennis rackets. I sprang after them, but as I was crashing through the shrubbery, I saw in an alternate vision, as if life's course constantly branched, Lo in slacks and her companion in shorts, trudging up and down a small weedy area and beating bushes with their rackets in listless search for their last lost ball. I itemise these sunny nothings mainly to prove to my judges that I did everything in my power to give my Lolita a really good time. How charming it was to see her, a child herself, showing another child some of her few accomplishments, such as, for example, a special way of jumping rope. With her right hand holding her left arm behind her untanned back, the lesser nymphette, a diaphanous darling, would be all eyes, as the Pavonine sun was all eyes on the gravel under the flowering trees, while in the midst of that oculate paradise my freckled and raffish lass skipped, repeating the movements of so many others I had gloated over on the sun-shot, watered, damp-smelling sidewalks and ramparts of ancient Europe. Presently she would hand the rope back to her little Spanish friend, and watch in her turn the repeated lesson, and brush away the hair from her brow, and fold her arms, and step on one toe with the other, or drop her hands loosely upon her still unflared hips. And I would satisfy myself that the damned staff had at last finished cleaning up our cottage, whereupon, flashing a smile to the shy, dark-haired page girl of my princess, and thrusting my fatherly fingers deep into Lo's hair from behind, and then gently but firmly clasping them around the nape of her neck, I would lead my reluctant pet to our small home for a quick connection before dinner. "Whose cat has scratched poor you?" a full-blown, fleshy, handsome woman of the repulsive type to which I was particularly attractive might ask me at the lodge during a table d'hôte dinner followed by dancing promised to Lo. This was one of the reasons why I tried to keep as far away from people as possible, while Lo, on the other hand, would do her utmost to draw as many potential witnesses into her orbit as she could. She would be, figuratively speaking, wagging her tiny tail, her whole behind, in fact, as little bitches do, while some grinning stranger accosted us and began a bright conversation with a comparative study of license plates. "Long way from home!" Inquisitive parents, in order to pump Lo about me, would suggest her going to a movie with their children. We had some close shaves. The waterfall nuisance pursued me, of course, in all our caravanseries. But I never realised how wafery their wall substance was until one evening, after I had loved too loudly, a neighbour's masculine cough filled the pores as clearly as mine would have done. The next morning, as I was having breakfast at the milk bar, Lo was a late sleeper, and I liked to bring her a pot of hot coffee in bed, my neighbour of the eve, an elderly fool wearing plain glasses on his long virtuous nose and a convention badge on his lapel, somehow managed to rig up a conversation with me, in the course of which he inquired if my missus was like his missus, a rather reluctant getter-upper when not on the farm. And had not the hideous danger I was skirting almost suffocated me, I might have enjoyed the odd look of surprise on his thin-lipped, weather-beaten face when I dryly answered, as I slithered off my stool, that I was, thank God, a widower. How sweet it was to bring that coffee to her, and then deny it until she had done her morning duty. And I was such a thoughtful friend, such a passionate father, such a good paediatrician, attending to all the wants of my little auburn brunette's body. My only grudge against nature was that I couldn't turn my Lolita inside out and apply voracious lips to her young matrix, her unknown heart, her nacreous liver, the sea grapes of her lungs, her comely twin kidneys. On especial tropical afternoons, in the sticky closeness of the siesta, I liked the cool feel of armchair leather against my massive nakedness as I held her in my lap. There she would be, a typical kid picking her nose while engrossed in the lighter sections of a newspaper, as indifferent to my ecstasy as if it were something she had sat upon, a shoe, a doll, the handle of a tennis racket, and was too indolent to remove. Her eyes would follow the adventures of her favourite strip characters. There was one well-drawn, sloppy bobby soxer with high cheekbones and angular gestures that I was not above enjoying myself. she studied the photographic results of head-on collisions. She never doubted the reality of place, time, and circumstance alleged to match the publicity pictures of naked-thighed beauties, and she was curiously fascinated by the photographs of local brides, some in full wedding apparel, holding bouquets and wearing glasses. A fly would settle and walk in the vicinity of her navel, or explore her tender, pale areolas. She tried to catch it in her fist, Charlotte's method, and then would turn to the column, "Let's Explore Your Mind." "Let's explore your mind. Would sex crimes be reduced if children obeyed a few don'ts? Don't play around public toilets. Don't take candy or rides from strangers. If picked up, mark down the license of the car." "And the brand of the candy," I volunteered. She went on, her cheek recedent against mine, pursuant. And this was a good day. Mark, O reader. "If you don't have a pencil but are old enough to read, we," I quip-quoted, "medieval mariners have placed in this bottle." "If," she repeated, "you don't have a pencil but are old enough to read and write." "This is what the guy means, isn't it, you dope? Scratch the number somewhere on the roadside. With your little claws, Lolita." She had entered my world, Umber and Black Humberland, with rash curiosity. She surveyed it with a shrug of amused distaste, and it seemed to me now that she was ready to turn away from it with something akin to plain repulsion. Never did she vibrate under my touch, and a strident, "What do you think you're doing?" was all I got for my pains. To the wonderland I had to offer, my fool preferred the corniest movies, the most cloying fudge. To think that between a hamburger and a humburger she would invariably with icy precision plump for the former. There is nothing more atrociously cruel than an adored child. Did I mention the name of that milk bar I visited a moment ago? It was, of all things, the Frigid Queen. Smiling a little sadly, I dubbed her my Frigid Princess. She did not see the wistful joke. Oh, do not scowl at me, reader. I do not intend to convey the impression that I did not manage to be happy. Reader must understand that in the possession and thraldom of a nymphette, the enchanted traveller stands, as it were, beyond happiness. For there is no other bliss on earth comparable to that of fondling a nymphette. It is hors concours, that bliss. It belongs to another class, another plane of sensitivity. Despite our tiffs, despite her nastiness, despite all the fuss and faces she made, and the vulgarity and the danger, and the horrible hopelessness of it all, I still dwelled deep in my elected paradise, a paradise whose skies were the colour of hell flames, but still a paradise. The able psychiatrist who studies my case, and whom by now Dr. Humbert has plunged, I trust, into a state of leporine fascination, is no doubt anxious to have me take my Lolita to the seaside, and have me find there at last the gratification of a lifetime urge and a release from the subconscious obsession of an incomplete childhood romance with the initial little Miss Lee. Well, comrade, let me tell you that I did look for a beach, though I also have to confess that by the time we reached its mirage of grey water, so many delights had already been granted me by my travelling companion that the search for a kingdom by the sea, a sublimated Riviera or what not, far from being the impulse of the subconscious, had become the rational pursuit of a purely theoretical thrill. The angels knew it and arranged things accordingly. A visit to a plausible cove on the Atlantic side was completely messed up by foul weather. A thick, damp sky, muddy waves, a sense of boundless but somehow matter-of-fact mist. What could be further removed from the crisp charm, the sapphire occasion, the rosy contingency of my Riviera romance? A couple of semi-tropical beaches on the Gulf, though bright enough, were starred and spattered by venomous beasties and swept by hurricane winds. Finally, on a Californian beach, facing the phantom of the Pacific, I hit upon some rather perverse privacy in a kind of cave whence you could hear the shrieks of a lot of Girl Scouts taking their first surf bath on a separate part of the beach, behind rotting trees. But the fog was like a wet blanket, and the sand was gritty and clammy, and lo was all goose flesh and grit, and for the first time in my life I had as little desire for her as for a manatee. Perhaps my learned readers may perk up if I tell them that even if we discovered a piece of sympathetic seaside somewhere, it would have come too late, since my real liberation had occurred much earlier, at the moment, in point of fact, when Annabel Hayes, alias Dolores Lee, alias Lolita, had appeared to me, golden and brown, kneeling, looking up on that shoddy veranda in a kind of fictitious, dishonest, but eminently satisfactory seaside arrangement, although there was nothing but a second-rate lake in the neighbourhood. So much for those special sensations, influenced if not actually brought about by the tenets of modern psychiatry. Consequently, I turned away. I headed my Lolita away from beaches which were either too bleak when lone or too populous when ablaze. However, in recollection, I suppose, of my hopeless hauntings of public parks in Europe, I was still keenly interested in outdoor activities and desirous of finding suitable playgrounds in the open where I had suffered such shameful privations. Here, too, I was to be thwarted. The disappointment I must now register, as I gently grade my story into an expression of the continuous risk and dread that ran through my bliss, should in no wise reflect on the lyrical, epic, tragic, but never Arcadian American wilds. They are beautiful, heart-rendingly beautiful, those wilds, with a quality of wide-eyed, unsung, innocent surrender that my lacquered, toy-bright Swiss villages and exhaustively lauded Alps no longer possess. Innumerable lovers have clipped and kissed on the trim turf of old-world mountainsides, on the inner spring moss, by a handy hygienic rill, on rustic benches under the initialed oaks, and in so many cabanas in so many beech forests. But in the wilds of America, the open-air lover will not find it easy to indulge in the most ancient of all crimes and pastimes. Poisonous plants burn his sweetheart's buttocks, nameless insects sting his. Sharp items on the forest floor prick his knees, insects hers. And all around there abides a sustained rustle of potential snakes, Khadij of semi-extinct dragons, while the crab-like seeds of ferocious flowers cling in a hideous green crust to gartered black sock and sloppy white sock alike. I am exaggerating a little. One summer noon, just below timberline, where heavenly-hued blossoms that I would fain call larkspur crowded all along a pearly mountain brook, we did find, Lolita and I, a secluded romantic spot, 100 feet or so above the pass where we had left our car. The slope seemed untrodden. A last panting pine was taking a well-earned breather on the rock it had reached. A marmot whistled at us and withdrew. Beneath the lap-robe I had spread for low, dry flowers crepitated softly. Venus came and went. The jagged cliff crowning the upper talus and the tangle of shrubs growing below us seemed to offer us a protection from sun and man alike. Alas, I had not reckoned with a faint side trail that curled up in cagey fashion among the shrubs and rocks a few feet from us. It was then that we came closer to detection than ever before, and no wonder the experience curbed forever my yearning for rural amours. I remember the operation was over, all over, and she was weeping in my arms, a salutary storm of sobs after one of the fits of moodiness that had become so frequent with her in the course of that otherwise admirable year. I had just retracted some silly promise she had forced me to make in a moment of blind, impatient passion, and there she was, sprawling and sobbing and pinching my caressing hand, and I was laughing happily, and the atrocious, unbelievable, unbearable, and I suspect eternal horror that I know now was still but a dot of blackness in the blue of my bliss. And so we lay, when with one of those jolts that have ended by knocking my poor heart out of its groove, I met the unblinking dark eyes of two strange and beautiful children, fawnlit and nymphet, whom their identical flat dark hair and bloodless cheeks proclaim siblings, if not twins. They stood crouching and gaping at us, both in blue playsuits, blending with the mountain blossoms. I plucked at the lap-robe for desperate concealment, and within the same instant something that looked like a polka-dotted push-ball among the undergrowth a few paces away went into a turning motion which was transformed into the gradually rising figure of a stout lady with a raven-black bob, who automatically added a wild lily to her bouquet while staring over her shoulder at us from behind her lovely carved bluestone children. Now that I have an altogether different mess on my conscience, I know I am a courageous man, but in those days I was not aware of it, and I remember being surprised by my own coolness. With the quiet murmured order one gives a sweat-stained, distracted, cringing, trained animal, even in the worst of plights, what mad hope or hate makes the young beast's flank pulsate? What black stars pierced the heart of the tamer. I made Lo get up, and we decorously walked and then indecorously scuttled down to the car. Behind it, a nifty station wagon was parked, and a handsome Assyrian with a little blue-black beard, un monsieur très bien, in silk shirt and magenta slacks, presumably the corpulent botanist's husband, was gravely taking the picture of a signboard giving the altitude of the pass. It was well over 10,000 feet, and I was quite out of breath. And with a scrunch and a skid we drove off, Lo still struggling with her clothes and swearing at me in language that I never dreamed little girls could know, let alone use. There were other unpleasant incidents. There was the movie theatre once, for example. Lo at the time still had for the cinema a veritable passion. It was to decline into tepid condescension during her second high school year. We took in, voluptuously and indiscriminately, 150, 200 programmes during that 1 year. And during some of the denser periods of movie-going, we saw many of the newsreels up to half a dozen times, since the same weekly one went with different main pictures and pursued us from town to town. Her favourite kinds were, in this order, musicals, underworlders, westerners. In the first, real singers and dancers had unreal stage careers in an essentially grief-proof sphere of existence, wherefrom death and truth were banned, and where, at the end, white-haired, dewy-eyed, technically deathless, the initially reluctant father of a show-crazy girl always finished by applauding her apotheosis on fabulous Broadway. The underworld was a world apart. There, heroic newspapermen were tortured, telephone bills ran to billions, and in a robust atmosphere of incompetent marksmanship, villains were chased through sewers and storehouses by pathologically fearless cops. I was to give them less exercise. Finally, there was the mahogany landscape, the florid-faced, blue-eyed rough riders, the prim, pretty schoolteacher arriving in Roaring Gulch, the rearing horse, the spectacular stampede, the pistol thrust through the shivered windowpane, the stupendous fistfight, the crashing mountain of dusty old-fashioned furniture, the table used as a weapon, the timely somersault, the pinned hand still groping for the dropped Bowie knife, the grunt, the sweet crash of fist against chin, the kick in the belly, the flying tackle, and immediately after a plethora of pain that would have hospitalised a Hercules, I should know by now, nothing to show but a rather becoming bruise on the bronzed cheek of the warmed-up hero embracing his gorgeous frontier bride. I remember one matinee in a small airless theatre crammed with children and reeking with the hot breath of popcorn. The moon was yellow above the neckerchiefed crooner, and his finger was on his strum string and his foot was on a pine log. And I had innocently encircled Lo's shoulder and approached my jawbone to her temple, when two harpies behind us started muttering the queerest things. I do not know if I understood right, but what I thought I did made me withdraw my gentle hand, and of course the rest of the show was a fog to me. Another jolt, I remember, is connected with a little burg we were traversing at night during our return journey. Some 20 miles earlier, I had happened to tell her that the day school she would attend at Beardsley was a rather high-class, non-co-educational one, with no modern nonsense. Whereupon, Lo treated me to one of those furious harangues of hers, where entreaty and insult, self-assertion and double-talk, vicious vulgarity and childish despair, were interwoven in an exasperating semblance of logic which prompted a semblance of explanation from me. Enmeshed in her wild words, "Swell chance, I'd be a sap if I took your opinion seriously. Stinker, you can't boss me, I despise you," and so forth, I drove through the slumbering town at a 50-mile-per-hour pace in continuance of my smooth highway swoosh, and a twosome of patrolmen put their spotlight on the car and told me to pull over. I shushed Lo, who was automatically raving on. The men peered at her and me with malevolent curiosity. Suddenly all dimples, she beamed sweetly at them, as she never did at my orchidous masculinity. For in a sense, my Lo was even more scared of the law than I. And when the kind officers pardoned us, and servilely we crawled on, her eyelids closed and fluttered as she mimicked limp prostration. At this point, I have a curious confession to make. You will laugh, but really and truly, I somehow never managed to find out quite exactly what the legal situation was. I do not know it yet. Oh, I've learned a few odds and ends. Alabama prohibits a guardian from changing the ward's residence without an order of the court. Minnesota, to whom I take off my hat, provides that when a relative assumes permanent care and custody of any child under 14, the authority of a court does not come into play. Query: is the stepfather of a gaspingly adorable pubescent pet, a stepfather of only 1 month's standing, a neurotic widower of mature years and small but independent means, with the parapets of Europe, a divorce and a few madhouses behind him, is he to be considered a relative, and thus a natural guardian? And if not, must I, and could I reasonably dare, notify some welfare board and file a petition? How do you file a petition, and have a court's agent investigate meek, fishy me, and dangerous Dolores Hayes? The many books on marriage, rape, adoption, and so on that I guiltily consulted at public libraries of big and small towns told me nothing beyond darkly insinuating that the state is the super guardian of minor children. Pilvin and Zappel, if I remember their names right, in an impressive volume on the legal side of marriage, completely ignored stepfathers with motherless girls on their hands. And my best friend, a social service monograph, Chicago, 1936, which was dug out for me at great pains from a dusty storage recess by an innocent old spinster, said, "There is no principle that every minor must have a guardian. The court is passive and enters the fray only when the child's situation becomes conspicuously perilous." A guardian, I concluded, was appointed only when he expressed his solemn and formal desire. But months might elapse before he was given notice to appear at a hearing and grow his pair of grey wings, and in the meantime the fair demon child was legally left to her own devices, which, after all, was the case of Dolores Hayes. Then came the hearing, a few questions from the bench, a few reassuring answers from the attorney, a smile, a nod, a light drizzle outside, and the appointment was made. And still I dared not. Keep away. Be a mouse. Curl up in your hole. Courts became extravagantly active only when there was some money question involved. Two greedy guardians, a robbed orphan, a third still greedier party. But here all was in perfect order. An inventory had been made, and her mother's small property was waiting untouched for Dolores Hayes to grow up. The best policy seemed to be to refrain from any application. Or would some busybody, some humane society, butt in if I kept too quiet? Friend Farlow, who was a lawyer of sorts and ought to have been able to give me some solid advice, was too much occupied with Jean's cancer to do anything more than what he had promised, namely, to look after Charlotte's meagre estate while I recovered very gradually from the shock of her death. I had conditioned him into believing Dolores was my natural child, and so could not expect him to bother his head about the situation. I am, as the reader must have gathered by now, a poor businessman. But neither ignorance nor indolence should have prevented me from seeking professional advice elsewhere. What stopped me was the awful feeling that if I meddled with fate in any way and tried to rationalise her fantastic gift, that gift would be snatched away, like the palace on the mountaintop in the Oriental tale, which vanished whenever a prospective owner asked its custodian how come a strip of sunset sky was clearly visible from afar between black rock and foundation. I decided that at Beardsley, the site of Beardsley College for Women, I would have access to works of reference that I had not yet been able to study, such as Verner's Treatise on the American Law of Guardianship and certain United States Children's Bureau publications. I also decided that anything was better for Lo than the demoralizing idleness in which she lived. I could persuade her to do so many things, their list might stupefy a professional educator, but no matter how I pleaded or stormed, I could never make her read any other book than the so-called comic books or stories in magazines for American females. Any literature, a peg higher, smacked to her of school. And though theoretically willing to enjoy A Girl of the Limberlost or The Arabian Nights or Little Women, she was quite sure she would not fritter away her vacation on such highbrow reading matter. I now think it was a great mistake to move east again and have her go to that private school in Beardsley, instead of somehow scrambling across the Mexican border while the scrambling was good, so as to lie low for a couple of years in subtropical bliss until I could safely marry my little Creole. For I must confess that depending on the condition of my glands and ganglia, I could switch in the course of the same day from one pole of insanity to the other, from the thought that around 1950 I would have to get rid somehow of a difficult adolescent whose magic nymphage had evaporated, to the thought that with patience and luck I might have her produce eventually a nymphet with my blood in her exquisite veins, a Lolita II, who would be 8 or 9 around 1960, when I would still be dans la fosse de l'âge. Indeed, the telescopy of my mind, or unmind, was strong enough to distinguish in the remoteness of time a vieillard encore vert, or was it green rot? Bizarre, tender, salivating Dr. Humbert, practicing on a supremely lovely Lolita III the art of being a granddad. In the days of that wild journey of ours, I doubted not that as father to Lolita I, I was a ridiculous failure. I did my best. I read and reread a book with the unintentionally biblical title Know Your Own Daughter, which I got at the same store where I bought Lo for her 13th birthday, a deluxe volume with commercially beautiful illustrations of Andersen's The Little Mermaid. But even at our very best moments, when we sat reading on a rainy day, Lo's glance skipping from the window to her wristwatch and back again, or had a quiet, hearty meal in a crowded diner, or played a childish game of cards, or went shopping, or silently stared with other motorists and their children at some smashed, blood-bespattered car with a young woman's shoe in the ditch. Lo, as we drove on, that was the exact type of moccasin I was trying to describe to that jerk in the store. On all those random occasions, I seemed to myself as implausible a father as she seemed to be a daughter. Was perhaps guilty locomotion instrumental in vitiating our powers of impersonation? Would improvement be forthcoming with a fixed domicile and a routine schoolgirl's day? In my choice of Beardsley, I was guided not only by the fact of there being a comparatively sedate school for girls located there, but also by the presence of the women's college. In my desire to get myself cassé, to attach myself somehow to some pattern surface which my stripes would blend with, I thought of a man I knew in the Department of French at Beardsley College. He was good enough to use my textbook in his classes, and had attempted to get me over once to deliver a lecture. I had no intention of doing so, since, as I have once remarked in the course of these confessions, there are few physiques I loathe more than the heavy, low-slung pelvis, thick calves, and deplorable complexion of the average co-ed, in whom I see, maybe, the coffin of coarse female flesh within which my nymphets are buried alive. But I did crave for a label, a background, and a simulacrum. And, as presently will become clear, there was a reason, a rather zany reason, why old Gaston Godin's company would be particularly safe. Finally, there was the money question. My income was cracking under the strain of our joyride. True, I clung to the cheaper motor courts, but every now and then there would be a loud hotel de luxe or a pretentious dude ranch to mutilate our budget. Staggering sums, moreover, were expended on sightseeing and Lowe's clothes. And the old Hayes bus, although a still vigorous and very devoted machine, necessitated numerous minor and major repairs. In one of our strip maps that has happened to survive among the papers which the authorities have so kindly allowed me to use for the purpose of writing my statement, I find some jottings that help me compute the following. During that extravagant year, 1947 to 1948, August to August, lodgings and food cost us around $5,500. Gas, oil and repairs, $1,234, and various extras almost as much, so that during about 150 days of actual motion, we covered about 27,000 miles, plus some 200 days of interpolated standstills, this modest rentier spent around $8,000, or better say $10,000, because, unpractical as I am, I have surely forgotten the number of items. And so we rolled east. I, more devastated than braced with the satisfaction of my passion, and she glowing with health, her bi-iliac garland still as brief as a lad's, although she had added 2 inches to her stature and 8 pounds to her weight. We had been everywhere. We had really seen nothing. And I catch myself thinking today that our long journey had only defiled with a sinuous trail of slime the lovely, trustful, dreamy, enormous country that by then, in retrospect, was no more to us than a collection of dog-eared maps, ruined tour books, old tires, and her sobs in the night, every night, the moment I feign sleep. When, through decorations of light and shade, we drove up to 14 Thayer Street, a grave little lad met us with the keys and a note from Gaston, who had rented the house for us. My Lo, without granting her new surroundings one glance, unseeingly turned on the radio to which instinct led her, and lay down on the living room sofa with a batch of old magazines which in the same precise and blind manner she landed by dipping her hand into the nether anatomy of a lamp table. I really did not mind where to dwell, provided I could lock my Lolita up somewhere. But I had, I suppose, in the course of my correspondence with vague Gaston, vaguely visualized a house of ivied brick. Actually, the place bore a dejected resemblance to the Hayes home, a mere 400 miles distant. And it was the same sort of dull grey frame affair with a shingled roof and dull green drill awnings, and the rooms, though smaller and furnished in a more consistent plush and plate style, were arranged in much the same order. My study turned out to be, however, a much larger room, lined from floor to ceiling with some 2,000 books on chemistry, which my landlord, on sabbatical leave for the time being, taught at Beardsley College. I had hoped Beardsley School for Girls, an expensive day school, with lunch thrown in and a glamorous gymnasium, would, while cultivating all those young bodies, provide some formal education for their minds as well. Gaston Godin, who was seldom right in his judgment of American habitus, had warned me that the institution might turn out to be one of those where girls are taught, as he put it with a foreigner's love for such things, not to spell very well, but to smell very well. I don't think they achieved even that. At my first interview with Headmistress Pratt, she approved of my child's nice blue eyes. Blue? Lolita? And of my own friendship with that French genius. A genius? Gaston? And then, having turned Dolly over to a Miss Cormorant, she wrinkled her brow with a kind of recueillement and said, "We are not so much concerned, Mr. Humbert, with having our students become bookworms or to be able to reel off all the capitals of Europe which nobody knows anyway, or learn by heart the dates of forgotten battles. What we are concerned with is the adjustment of the child to group life. That is why we stress the four Ds, dramatics, dance, debating, and dating. We are confronted by certain facts. Your delightful Dolly will presently enter an age group where dates, dating, date dress, date book, date etiquette mean as much to her as, say, business, business connections, business success mean to you, or as much as, smiling, the happiness of my girls means to me. Dorothy Humbird is already involved in a whole system of social life which consists, whether we like it or not, of hot dog stands, corner drug stores, malts and cokes, movies, square dancing, blanket parties on beaches, and even hair-fixing parties. Naturally, at Beardsley School, we disapprove of some of these activities, but we rechannel others into more constructive directions. But we do try to turn our backs on the fog and squarely face the sunshine. To put it briefly, while adopting certain teaching techniques, we are more interested in communication than in composition. That is, with due respect to Shakespeare and others, we want our girls to communicate freely with the live world around them rather than plunge into musty old books. We are still groping, perhaps, but we grope intelligently, like a gynecologist feeling a tumour. We think, Dr. Humbert, in organismal and organisational terms. We have done away with the mass of irrelevant topics that have traditionally been presented to young girls, leaving no place in former days for the knowledges and the skills and the attitudes they will need in managing their lives and, as the cynic might add, the lives of their husbands. Mr. Humberson, let us put it this way. The position of a star is important, but the most practical spot for an icebox in the kitchen may be even more important to the budding housewife. You say that all you expect a child to obtain from school is a sound education. But what do we mean by education? In the old days, it was in the main a verbal phenomenon. I mean, you could have a child learn by heart a good encyclopedia, and he or she would know as much or more than a school could offer. Dr. Hummer, do you realize that for the modern pre-adolescent child, medieval dates are of less vital value than weekend ones? Twinkle? To repeat a pun that I heard the Beardsley College psychoanalyst permit herself the other day. We live not only in a world of thoughts, but also in a world of things. Words without experience are meaningless. What on earth can Dorothy Humberson care for Greece and the Orient and their harems and slaves? This programme rather appalled me, but I spoke to two intelligent ladies who had been connected with the school, and they affirmed that the girls did quite a bit of sound reading, and that the communication line was more or less ballyhoo, aimed at giving old-fashioned Beardsley School a financially remunerative modern touch, though actually it remained as prim as a prawn. Another reason attracted me to that particular school may seem funny to some readers, but it was very important to me, for that is the way I'm made. Across our street, exactly in front of our house, there was, I noticed, a gap of weedy wasteland, with some colourful bushes and a pile of bricks and a few scattered planks, and the foam of shabby mauve and chrome autumn roadside flowers. And through that gap, you could see a shimmery section of School Road running parallel to our Thayer Street, and immediately beyond that, the playground of the school. Apart from the psychological comfort this general arrangement should afford me by keeping Dolly's day adjacent to mine, I immediately foresaw the pleasure I would have in distinguishing from my study bedroom, by means of powerful binoculars, the statistically inevitable percentage of nymphettes among the other girl children playing around Dolly during recess. Unfortunately, on the very first day of school, workmen arrived to put up a fence some way down the gap, and in no time a construction of tawny wood maliciously arose beyond that fence, utterly blocking my magic vista. And as soon as they had erected a sufficient amount of material to spoil everything, those absurd builders suspended their work and never appeared again. In a street called Thayer Street, in the residential green, fawn and golden of a mellow academic townlet, one was bound to have a few amiable fine dayers yelping at you. I prided myself on the exact temperature of my relations with them, never rude, always aloof. My West Dorn neighbour, who might have been a businessman or a college teacher or both, would speak to me once in a while as he barbered some late garden blooms or watered his car or at a later date defrosted his driveway. I don't mind if these verbs are all wrong, but my brief grunts, just sufficiently articulate to sound like conventional assents or interrogative pause fillers, precluded any evolution towards chumminess. Of the two houses flanking the bit of scrubby waste opposite, one was closed, and the other contained two professors of English, tweedy and short-haired Miss Lester and fadedly feminine Miss Fabian, whose only subject of brief sidewalk conversation with me was, God bless their tact, the young loveliness of my daughter and the naive charm of Gaston Godin. My East Door neighbour was by far the most dangerous one, a sharp-nosed character whose late brother had been attached to the college as superintendent of buildings and grounds. I remember her waylaying Dolly while I stood at the living room window feverishly awaiting my darling's return from school. The odious spinster, trying to conceal her morbid inquisitiveness under a mask of dulcet goodwill, stood leaning on her slim umbrella. The sleet had just stopped, a cold wet sun had sidled out, and Dolly, her brown coat open despite the raw weather, her structural heap of books pressed against her stomach, her knees showing pink above her clumsy Wellingtons, a sheepish, frightened little smile flitting over and off her snub-nosed face, which, owing perhaps to the pale wintry light, looked almost plain in a rustic German Magdalene-like way, as she stood there and dealt with Miss East's questions.
"And where is your mother, my dear? And what is your poor father's occupation? And where did you live before?"
Another time the loathsome creature accosted me with a welcoming whine, but I evaded her. And a few days later there came from her a note in a blue-margined envelope, a nice mixture of poison and treacle, suggesting Dolly come over on a Sunday and curl up in a chair to look through the loads of beautiful books my dear mother gave me when I was a child, instead of having the radio on at full blast till all hours of the night. I also had to be careful in regard to a Miss Holligan, a charwoman and cook of sorts, whom I inherited with the vacuum cleaner from the previous tenants. Dolly got lunch at school, so that this was no trouble, and I had become adept at providing her with a big breakfast and warming up the dinner that Mrs. Holligan prepared before leaving. That kindly and harmless woman had, thank God, a rather bleary eye that missed details, and I had become a great expert in bed-making. But still I was continuously obsessed by the feeling that some fatal stain had been left somewhere, or that, on the rare occasions where Holligan's presence happened to coincide with Lowe's, simple Lowe might succumb to buxom sympathy in the course of a cosy kitchen chat. I often felt we lived in a lighted house of glass, and that any moment some thin-lipped parchment face would peer through a carelessly unshaded window to obtain a free glimpse of things that the most jaded voyeur would have paid a small fortune to watch. A word about Gaston Godin. The main reason why I enjoyed, or at least tolerated with relief, his company was the spell of absolute security that his ample person cast on my secret. Not that he knew it. I had no special reason to confide in him, and he was much too self-centred and abstract to notice or suspect anything that might lead to a frank question on his part and a frank answer on mine. He spoke well of me to Beardsleyans. He was my good herald. Had he discovered Megu and Lolita's status, it would have interested him only in so far as throwing some light on the simplicity of my attitude toward him, which attitude was as free of polite strain as it was of ribald allusions, for despite his colourless mind and dim memory, he was perhaps aware that I knew more about him than the burghers of Beardsley did. He was a flabby, dough-faced, melancholy bachelor, tapering upward to a pair of narrow, not quite level shoulders, and a conical pear head which had sleek black hair on one side and only a few plastered wisps on the other. But the lower part of his body was enormous, and he ambulated with a curious elephantine stealth by means of phenomenally stout legs. He always wore black, even his tie was black. He seldom bathed. His English was a burlesque. And nonetheless, everybody considered him to be a supremely lovable, lovably freakish fellow. Neighbours pampered him. He knew by name all the small boys in our vicinity. He lived a few blocks away from me, and had some of them clean his sidewalk and burn leaves in his backyard, and bring wood from his shed, and even perform simple chores about the house. And he would feed them fancy chocolates with real liqueurs inside, in the privacy of an orientally furnished den in his basement, with amusing daggers and pistols arrayed on the mouldy, rug-adorned walls among the camouflaged hot water pipes. Upstairs he had a studio. He painted a little, the old fraud. He had decorated its sloping wall, it was really not more than a garret, with large photographs of pensive André Gide, Tchaikovsky, Norman Douglas, two other well-known English writers, Nijinsky, all thighs and fig leaves, Harold D. Doublename, a misty-eyed left-wing professor at a Midwestern university, and Marcel Proust. All these poor people seemed about to fall on you from their inclined plane. He had also an album with snapshots of all the Jackies and Dickies in the neighbourhood, and when I happened to thumb through it and make some casual remark, Gaston would purse his fat lips and murmur with a wistful pout, "Oui, ils sont gentils." His brown eyes would roam around the various sentimental and artistic bric-a-brac present, and his own banal toile, the conventionally primitive eyes, sliced guitars, blue nipples and geometric designs of the day, and with a vague gesture toward a painted wooden bowl or veined vase, he would say, "Prenez donc une de ces poires. La bonne dame d'en face m'en offre plus que je ne peux savourer." Or, "Mrs. Taylor vient de me donner ses dahlias, belles fleurs que j'exècre." Sombre, sad, full of world weariness. For obvious reasons, I preferred my house to his for the games of chess we had two or three times weekly. He looked like some old battered idol as he sat with his pudgy hands in his lap and stared at the board as if it were a corpse. Wheezing, he would meditate for 10 minutes, then make a losing move. Or the good man, even after more thought, might utter, "Au revoir," with a slow old dog woof that had a gargling sound at the back of it, which made his jowls wobble. And then he would lift his circumflex eyebrows with a deep sigh, as I pointed out to him that he was in check himself. Sometimes from where we sat in my cold study, I could hear Lowe's bare feet practicing dance techniques in the living room downstairs. But Gaston's outgoing senses were comfortably dulled, and he remained unaware of these naked rhythms. And one and two, weight transferred on a straight right leg, leg up and out to the side, and one and two, weight transferred on a straight right leg, leg up and out to the side, and one and two. And only when she started jumping, opening her legs at the height of the jump and flexing one leg, and extending the other, and flying and landing on her toes, only then did my pale, pompous, morose opponent rub his head or cheek as if confusing those distant thuds with the awful stabs of my formidable queen. Sometimes Lola would slouch in while we pondered the board, and it was every time a treat to see Gaston, his elephant eye still fixed on his pieces, ceremoniously rise to shake hands with her, and forthwith release her limp fingers, and without looking once at her, descend again into his chair to topple into the trap I had laid for him. One day around Christmas, after I had not seen him for a fortnight or so, he asked me, "Et tout vos filettes, ils viennent bien?" From which it became evident to me that he had multiplied my unique Lolita by the number of sartorial categories his downcast, moody eye had glimpsed during the whole series of her appearances. Blue jeans, a skirt, shorts, a quilted robe. I'm loath to dwell so long on the poor fellow. Sadly enough, a year later, during a voyage to Europe from which he did not return, he got involved in a sale histoire, in Naples, of all places. I would have hardly alluded to him at all had not his Beardsley existence had such a queer bearing on my case. I need him for my defence. There he was, devoid of any talent whatsoever, a mediocre teacher, a worthless scholar, a glum, repulsive, fat old invert, highly contemptuous of the American way of life, triumphantly ignorant of the English language. There he was in priggish New England, crooned over by the old and caressed by the young, oh, having a grand time and fooling everybody. And here was I. I'm now faced with a distasteful task of recording a definite drop in Lolita's morals. If her share in the ardours she kindled had never amounted to much, neither had pure lucre ever come to the fore. But I was weak, I was not wise. My schoolgirl nymphette had me in thrall. With the human element dwindling, the passion, the tenderness, and the torture only increased, and of this she took advantage. Her weekly allowance, paid to her under condition she fulfil her basic obligations, was 21 cents at the start of the Beardsley era, and went up to $1.05 before its end. This was a more than generous arrangement, seeing she constantly received from me all kinds of small presents, and had for the asking any sweetmeat or movie under the moon. Although, of course, I might fondly demand an additional kiss, or even a whole collection of assorted caresses, when I knew she coveted very badly some item of juvenile amusement. She was, however, not easy to deal with. Only very listlessly did she earn her 3 pennies, or 3 nickels, per day. And she proved to be a cruel negotiator whenever it was in her power to deny me certain life-wrecking, strange, slow, paradisal filters without which I could not live for more than a few days in a row, and which, because of the very nature of love's languor, I could not obtain by force. Knowing the magic and might of her own soft mouth, she managed, during one school year, to raise the bonus price of a fancy embrace to 3, even 4 bucks. Oh, reader, laugh not, as you imagine me on the very rack of joy, noisily emitting dimes and quarters and great big silver dollars like some sonorous, jingly and wholly demented machine vomiting riches. And in the margin of that leaping epilepsy, she would firmly clutch a handful of coins in her little fist, which anyway I used to pry open afterwards unless she gave me the slip, scrambling away to hide her loot. And just as every other day, I would cruise all around the school area and on comatose feet visit drugstores and peer into foggy lanes and listen to receding girl laughter in between my heartthrobs and the falling leaves. So every now and then I would burgle her room and scrutinise torn papers in the wastebasket with the painted roses and look under the pillow of the virginal bed I just made myself. Once I found 8 $1 notes in one of her books, fittingly Treasure Island, and once a hole in the wall behind Whistler's mother yielded as much as $24 and some change, say $24.60, which I quietly removed, upon which, next day, she accused to my face honest Mrs. Holligan for being a filthy thief. Eventually she lived up to her IQ by finding a safer hoarding place, which I never discovered. But by that time I had brought prices down drastically by having her earn the hard and nauseous way permission to participate in the school's theatrical programme. Because what I feared most was not that she might ruin me, but that she might accumulate sufficient cash to run away. I believe the poor, fierce-eyed child had figured out that with a mere $50 in her purse she might somehow reach Broadway or Hollywood, or the foul kitchen of a diner, help wanted, in a dismal ex-prairie state, with the wind blowing and the stars blinking, and the cars and the bars and the barmen, and everything soiled, torn, dead. I did my best, Your Honour, to tackle the problem of boys. Oh, I used even to read in the Beardsley Star a so-called column for teens to find out how to behave. A word to fathers. Don't frighten away your daughter's friend. Maybe it is a bit hard for you to realise that now the boys are finding her attractive. To you, she is still a little girl. To the boys, she's charming and fun, lovely and gay. They like her. Today you clinch big deals in an executive's office, but yesterday you were just high school gym carrying Jane's school books. Remember? Don't you want your daughter, now that her turn has come, to be happy in the admiration and company of boys she likes? Don't you want them to have wholesome fun together? Wholesome fun? Good Lord! Why not treat the young fellows as guests in your house? Why not make conversation with them, draw them out, make them laugh and feel at ease? Welcome, fellow, to this bordello. If she breaks the rules, don't explode out loud in front of her partner in crime. Let her take the brunt of your displeasure in private. And stop making the boys feel she's the daughter of an old ogre. First of all, the old ogre drew up a list under absolutely forbidden and another under reluctantly allowed. Absolutely forbidden were dates, single or double or triple, the next step being, of course, mass orgy. She might visit a candy bar with her girlfriends, and there giggle chat with occasional young males while I waited in the car at a discreet distance. And I promised her that if her group were invited by a socially acceptable group in Butler's Academy for Boys for their annual ball, heavily chaperoned, of course, I might consider the question whether a girl of 14 can don her first formal, a kind of gown that makes thin-armed teenagers look like flamingos. Moreover, I promised her to throw a party at our house to which she would be allowed to invite her prettier girlfriends and the nicer boys she would have met by that time at the Butler dance. But I was quite positive that as long as my regime lasted, she would never, never be permitted to go with a youngster in rut to a movie, or neck in a car, or go to boy-girl parties at the houses of schoolmates, or indulge out of my earshot in boy-girl telephone conversations, even if only discussing his relations with a friend of mine. Lowe was enraged by all this, called me a lousy crook and worse, and I would probably have lost my temper had I not soon discovered, to my sweetest relief, that what really angered her was my depriving her not of a specific satisfaction, but of a general right. I was impinging, you see, on the conventional programme, the stock pastimes, the things that are done, the routine of youth. For there is nothing more conservative than a child, especially a girl child, be she the most auburn and russet, the most mythopoeic nymphette in October's orchard haze. Do not misunderstand me. I cannot be absolutely certain that in the course of the winter she did not manage to have, in a casual way, improper contacts with unknown young fellows. Of course, no matter how closely I controlled her leisure, there would constantly occur unaccounted-for time leaks with over-elaborate explanations to stop them in retrospect. Of course, my jealousy would constantly catch its jagged claw in the fine fabrics of nymphet falsity. But I did definitely feel, and can now vouchsafe for the accuracy of my feeling, that there was no reason for serious alarm. I felt that way not because I never once discovered any palpable hard young throat to crush among the masculine mutes that flickered somewhere in the background, because it was to me overwhelmingly obvious, a favourite expression with my Aunt Sybil, that all varieties of high school boys, from the perspiring nincompoop whom holding hand thrills to the self-sufficient rapist with pustules and a souped-up car, equally bored my sophisticated young mistress. All this noise about boys gags me, she had scrawled on the inside of a schoolbook. And underneath, in Mona's hand, Mona is due any minute now, there was the sly quip, what about rigour? Due too. Faceless, then, are the chappies I happened to see in her company. There was, for instance, Red Sweater, who one day, the day we had the first snow, saw her home. From the parlour window I observed them talking near our porch. She wore her first cloth coat with a fur collar. There was a small brown cap on my favourite hairdo. The fringe in front and the swirl at the sides and the natural curls at the back. And her damp dark moccasins and white socks were more sloppy than ever. She pressed, as usual, her books to her chest while speaking or listening. And her feet gestured all the time. She would stand on her left instep with her right toe, remove it backward, cross her feet, rock slightly, sketch a few steps, and then start the series all over again. There was Windbreaker, who talked to her in front of a restaurant one Sunday afternoon while his mother and sister attempted to walk me away for a chat. I dragged along and looked back at my only love. She had developed more than one conventional mannerism, such as the polite adolescent way of showing one is literally doubled up by laughter by inclining one's head. And so, as she sensed my call, Still feigning helpless merriment, she walked backward a couple of steps and then faced about and walked toward me with a fading smile. On the other hand, I greatly liked, perhaps because it reminded me of her first unforgettable confession, her trick of sighing, "Oh dear," in humorous, wistful submission to fate, or emitting a long, "No," in a deep, almost growling undertone when the blow of fate had actually fallen. Above all, since we are speaking of movement and youth, I like to see her spinning up and down Thayer Street on her beautiful young bicycle, rising on the pedals to work on them lustily, then sinking back in a languid posture while the speed wore itself off. And then she would stop at our mailbox and, still astride, would flip through a magazine she found there and put it back and press her tongue to one side of her upper lip and push off with her foot and again sprint through pale shade and sun. On the whole, she seemed to me better adapted to her surroundings than I had hoped she would be, when considering my spoiled slave child and the bangles of demeanour she naively affected the winter before in California. Although I could never get used to the constant state of anxiety in which the guilty, the great, the tender-hearted live, I felt I was doing my best in the way of mimicry. As I lay on my narrow studio bed, after a session of adoration and despair in Lolita's cold bedroom, I used to review the concluded day by checking my own image as it prowled rather than passed before the mind's red eye. I watched, dark and handsome, not un-Celtic, probably high church, possibly very high church, Dr. Humbert, see his daughter off to school. I watched him greet with his slow smile and pleasantly arched thick black ad eyebrows good Mrs. Holligan, who smelled of the plague and would head, I know, for the master's gin at the first opportunity. With Mr. West, retired executioner or writer of religious tracts, who cared? I saw neighbour what's-his-name, I think they're French or Swiss, meditate in his frank windowed study over a typewriter, rather gaunt profiled, an almost Hitlerian cowlick on his pale brow. Weekends, wearing a well-tailored overcoat and brown gloves, Professor H. might be seen with his daughter strolling to Walton Inn, famous for its violet-ribboned china bunnies and chocolate boxes among which you sit and wait for a table for two, still filthy with your predecessor's crumbs. Seen on weekdays around 1 p.m, saluting with dignity argus-eyed east while manoeuvring the car out of the garage and around the damned evergreens and down onto the slippery road, raising a cold eye from book to clock in a positively sultry Beardsley College library, among bulky young women caught and petrified in the overflow of human knowledge, walking across the campus with the college clergyman, the Rev Rigger, who also taught Bible in Beardsley School. "Somebody told me her mother was a celebrated actress killed in an airplane accident." "Oh? My mistake, I presume. Is that so? I see. How sad." Sublimating her mother, eh? Slowly pushing my little pram through the labyrinth of the supermarket in the wake of Professor W., also a slow-moving and gentle widower with the eyes of a goat. Shoveling the snow in my shirt sleeves, a voluminous black-and-white muffler around my neck. Following with no show of rapacious haste, even taking time to wipe my feet on the mat, my schoolgirl daughter into the house. Taking Dolly to the dentist, pretty nurse beaming at her, old magazines. Ne montrez pas vos ombres. A dinner with Dolly in town. Mr. Edgar H. Humbert was seen eating his steak in the continental knife and fork manner, enjoying in duplicate a concert, two marble-faced, becalmed Frenchmen sitting side by side, with Monsieur H.H.'s musical little girl on her father's right and the musical little boy of Professor W., father spending a hygienic evening in Providence, on Monsieur Gigi's left. Opening the garage, a square of light that engulfs the car and is extinguished. Brightly pyjamaed, jerking down the window shade in Dolly's bedroom. Saturday morning, unseen, solemnly weighing the winter-bleached lassie in the bathroom. Seen and heard Sunday morning, no churchgoer after all, saying, "Don't be too late," to Dolly, who is bound for the covered court. Letting in a queerly observant schoolmate of Dolly's. "First time I've seen a man wearing a smoking jacket, sir, except in the movies, of course."
End of disc 6.